Mrs. Pearson see my eyes walk away. Then she asked me, do I know what my problem is? That I live in a country where English is spoke, and I don't know how to speak it. Nothing that sounds dumb will ever seem important, she say, no matter how important it might be. Nobody will ever understand you, nobody who can help you rise, unless you can speak the language of the nation. That's what she said.
Writer A.J. Verdell. She'll be back in just a moment to read more from and talk about her highly acclaimed new novel. The book is called The Good Negress, the story of a young woman coming of age in the early 1960s. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part two in a series of programs for Women's History Month. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. By 1963, Americans felt the early groundswells of the modern civil rights movement. Looking back to that time, we see signs of other forms of social progress, such as gender equality. In a new novel, A.J. Verdell examines those public groundswells by way of a quiet but powerful individual voice. Verdell's book is entitled The Good Negress. Narrated by a precocious but unschooled 14-year-old named Denise Palms, the novel takes us between rural Virginia, where Denise has lived part of her life, and Detroit, where she's been called home to live with her mother, her new stepfather, and her two brothers. The Good Negress is a book about life lessons, self-recognition, and the shaping of a young woman's intelligence. In a few minutes, we'll hear a passage in which Nisi recalls her dead father, a railway porter who dies unexpectedly. First, we begin with an excerpt about another important figure in Nisi's life, a teacher named Gloria Pearson. Here's A.J. Verdell.
The next time I saw her, Mrs. Pearson gave me a lecture. First, though, she asked me a question. I have a question to ask you, she begins. How am I going to explain how Marguerite acted without lying? Once you said that somebody told you everybody wanted to leave Virginia where you lived, remember? She asked me. I turn a corner in my mind. It is time for you to think about why all the people want to leave. Now, why do they? I parrot Luke Edward. They want to get someplace better. Right into what she has already decided to say, she launches, yes, Denise, that's an idea. It may be that you find the people you know want to migrate from one place to a place they think will be better. Of course, never having been to where they say they want to go, they don't really know how much better or worse it will be. Now do they? I look on in awe of how she thinks about things. Migrate, I write down. But what I'd like you to consider, and think deeply about it, is that we Negroes have been forced to live in temporary places. We have been made to consider, no matter who of our family and friends may be with us, that any day could bring an edict that we be split up, that we be sold. We are accustomed to separation, splitting up, losing members. Our families are the families that slavery made. I pretend I am a rat, that I can nibble with speed and ferociousness through whatever slices of pasty or dark or stale or crusty bread I find myself sandwiched between, slathered with mayonnaise, or mustard, or shame.
Angela Verdell, welcome to the National Humanities Center. I congratulate you on this wonderful novel, The Good Negress. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're happy to have you here. Tell me about this title. Is this a title that is intended to, what, provoke people? What are you up to here?
Well, The Good Negress is a book that is in large part about language. Denise, or Nisi, who's the central character, they used to be called heroines. Denise, who's my heroine, has quite a struggle with her teacher in Detroit to learn to speak accepted, sort of official, sort of downtown English. Uh-huh. And in the discussion of narrative, of language in narrative, the names that African Americans have been called, and those shifting names start to be real important. The power of naming, that kind of thing, which is an element of language.
Uh-huh.
And so Denise is called a good Negress or alluded to in that way in the book by this teacher. And so I chose that as a title simply because it's so interesting what happens to us when we look back at the names we've been called.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a lot of very ugly language. We have, and nowadays at the other end of the spectrum, we move to African American.
A hyphenated American name.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly.
I have to say, though, that I don't view the term Negress as ugly language.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Negress is a word of connotation and is very rarely seen used. But there's nothing, Negress is the feminine of Negro.
Right.
And as we say in American society, there's nothing wrong with Negro. It had a capital letter. And so we should think that the feminization of that would be okay.
What happens to Nisi, your main character, this voice that we hear throughout this book? Denise Palms is her name.
Right.
What happens to this little girl?
Well, Denise is growing up fine and happy in Detroit, like probably any other child anywhere. And she's 7 years old. Her father dies. She has two brothers, Luke Edward, who is 12, and David, who is 14. When her father dies, her mother, Marguerite, is just completely distressed, as might be expected. And she figures she has to go to work more, she has to do something. So because Luke Edward and David are at an age where they can fry their own bologna, Marguerite decides to take Denise to her mother, who lives in a town called Petoskey, Virginia.
And this is Grandmam.
This is Grandmam. Mm-hmm. And she takes Denise down and leaves Denise with Grandmam. So that Denise can get the appropriate raising for her age.
Uh-huh.
Not a very uncommon thing, the sort of shipping back and forth of children.
Right.
Done out of economic necessity.
Now, the passage that we heard you read just a moment ago at the before we began our conversation implies a lot of this traffic that Nisi experiences.
Yes.
As she moves between Virginia, rural Virginia, and Detroit.
Yes.
One of the things that she goes through is, well, she's coming of age in this book, and part of that, as you say, is her awareness of language and literacy. How that is going to help her fit into the world. Why do you lean on this? Why is this an important subject for you?
It's an important subject for me for a number of reasons. For Denise, in the book, it's an important subject because what I discovered was Denise has no problems with language. She's a very smart kid.
Right.
Mrs. Pearson discovers that pretty early on, and that's why Mrs. Pearson chooses to work with her.
But she's country.
She's country, and because her reading skills are not that great, Denise is not able to match what she's saying to what it looks like on the page,
uh-huh.
which is a sort of complicated stage in terms of literacy. Denise is very aware and very conscious and very able to name and articulate, but she's unable to recognize what she's naming and articulating when it shows up on the page.
In a way, you're talking about Black Americans and the way they fit into the white mainstream. That is to say, this is a deep psychological problem. How we understand what is out there, express it to ourselves, and in turn turn it back into the world. And whether, you know, in Nisi's case, whether she's accused of being stupid or dumb or country,
right.
We on the right track here?
Yes, and Nisi is very, very clear that she's recognizing things. In fact, she does have this suspicion that she's even recognizing things that other people are not recognizing.
Uh-huh.
But it's the translation from herself out to the larger world, to the official world, to the downtown world, that becomes gravely problematic. And there's an event in the book. Denise goes to get a job at Christmas time.
Right.
And the job that she's able to get and how she goes about getting that job is so interesting. She's got to count things,
mm-hmm.
and package them, and the man who's going to hire her looks up and sees this little Black girl with these braids and says, "Can you count to 50? And Denise is working really hard to count to 50 because Mrs. Pearson has said, "You've got to get off your F's more quickly. You've got to be clear about those F's." And so Denise is under a lot of pressure, even in that simple situation.
Now, the character that you call Gloria Pearson has been described in the material that you sent me to read about your book as what's the phrase here, a high-handed assimilationist?
Yes.
50-cent language here for a very important social phenomenon in American culture when it comes to Black people and white people.
Right.
What is Gloria about? What is she stand for, so to speak, right, in your book.
Well, it's interesting, this business of high-handed assimilationist, because in my mind, high-handed means, you know, she's got her arm kind of poised up in the air to slap kind of thing. Right. But certainly in parlance, high-handed means another thing, too. It means that you're standing way up and you have big ideas and large ideas. And Gloria Pearson is really a strong assimilationist. This is set in the early 60s. Mm. And she believes that you do not, absolutely do not have a chance unless you learn white skills.
Mm-hmm. Acting white, is that too strong?
No, it's not too strong at all. Gloria Pearson, there's a little teeny bit of fluidness in her assimilationist tactics because this is the beginning of the civil rights revolution, quote unquote. And I try to depict a very ordinary set of people, an ordinary family, sort of in the undercurrent of that civil rights movement.
Are you endorsing a position here, Angela? Are you ideologizing, as it were, and you're saying, well, the assimilationists are bad, the isolationists are good? How should we understand this interplay?
Well, I'm actually transcribing, to tell you the truth. I'm trying to depict all the different camps. And it was fun to me to see individual representatives of the camps and how they interact with each other.
Right.
And Denise's childhood was very appropriate for sort of identifying the camp that says, I don't really know how to take all this stuff, you know? I don't really know how to see this rumbling in the air and how to experience the sidewalk shaking and at the same time be trying to do all this stuff that some people are telling me I don't need to do.
I have to commend you. I mean, this is a marvelous book from the standpoint of what goes on strictly in terms of the life of this little girl and then what it implies for the larger social picture. You have written a political novel without a political statement, without being, to use this phrase, high-handed about it. How did that work for you?
Well, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and one of the things I often say to people is that everybody's born a lawyer. And I really felt very strongly that I was born making political arguments. Uh-huh. My first memory of huge numbers of people ever in my life is being on my father's shoulders at the March on Washington. And so I really feel like I spent my childhood trying to think about things in those kind of big terms, mm-hmm. big shifts. And I went later to the University of Chicago where they encouraged that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But politics and society is rooted in a household. Mm-hmm. And our households as African Americans or Black Americans or Negroes or Negresses mm-hmm. have a certain shape and a certain context. And a lot of times we live upstairs. And I was just trying to give that particular household, the Palms, Starks, Danbridge household, its space.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of making a political statement, well, political statements are conclusions. And in the act of narrative fiction, I'm not trying to draw conclusions. I'm trying to invite people into the arguments.
Here you're in the process rather than, you're giving us the means rather than the end, so to speak.
Exactly. And what was foremost for me was to create a psychological novel from a Black woman's or a Black girl child's perspective, which is, again, how the idea of a Negress is relevant.
Now, from an artistic standpoint, Angela, there have been Black women writing and contributing to our American literary scene or canon for years and years.
Many years.
But it is only recently that they have really sort of come to the fore and be taken seriously by the critics as well as the popular culture. What was your artistic responsibility, or what was the challenge in bringing this voice, this little, 12, 13, 14-year-old girl to your readers?
Well, there are two main challenges. The first one being to acknowledge her psychology, her psychological, intellectual development in the best and strongest way that I could, which encouraged me to work with time in the book to a very careful degree.
You mean figuring out how the narration's going to run?
Exactly. Being willing to say, well, when Denise is in this situation with Mrs. Pearson, what she actually thinks about is a sandwich. And when she thinks about that sandwich, this is how she thinks about the sandwich. Right. Well, why is she thinking about that? Because she makes them. She makes lunch for David. She makes lunch for her stepfather, Big Jim. So I was trying to legitimately transcribe the connections in her memory, which is how we sort of created this psychological narrative.
I remember one of my old teachers talking about something called the ladder of abstraction, and you move from the very concrete and the, you know, the domestically specific, the detail, all the way up to these very large issues. Again, I commend you. You have you've moved up and down on that ladder with great skill.
Well, thank you very much. Abstraction is not something that we get as Black women. We are not expected to be abstract. We're not encouraged to be abstract. We're encouraged to be concrete and orderly and disciplined and clean, cook and iron.
Let's talk about, speaking of Black women, let's talk about one of the central characters here, and that would be the formidable character of Mrs. Dambridge, the grandmam.
Right.
Are you preaching to, for, against, around the idea of matriarchy here when you present this character to us?
Well, matriarchy is a fact in African-American Black communities, as it is a fact in other communities. And as a historical fact, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, I think. I think that there are some indications possibly right now that, that matriarchy might be disintegrating a little bit.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a reality. Uh-huh. As I said, I'm really trying to transcribe. In terms of grandmam, I grew up with three great-grandmothers and two grandmothers. I lost my first great-grandmother when I was 13, so I was a big girl. And one of the things that is true about the good Negress is she's a person who has responded to a lot of pressures. Societal pressure, official pressure, mother pressure, brother pressure, father pressure, a whole series of things. And grandmam was actually a fusing of all this very old, very certain grandmotherliness that helped to raise me. Mm-hmm. And so that's why grandmam, I think, is so formidable and so certain. Not always right, but very certain about what she's doing.
What about the figures of the adult Black males in this book? Here, in a way, fictionally, and then again, we could extract your themes from your novel and apply them to our society in the 1990s. We're talking about some really serious problems on the Black domestic scene. Role models, who is it that young Black kids, little girls or boys, look to when they shape themselves?
Well, you know, life is sort of complicated, and role modeling as part of life is complicated. And if I had one big failure in The Good Negress, I think it was that I couldn't strip it far enough to make it less complicated like fiction is supposed to be.
Right.
But
I'd hardly call that a failure. I mean, what you've done in this book is extraordinary from the standpoint of the men as well as the women.
Well, thank you very much. In terms of role modeling and Black men, I mean, it's no secret. It's a big discussion right now about what's going on with Black men. And I was delighted to have Denise and her problems with her brothers and her father to work on that issue. Denise is lucky, because she's enchanted with the memory of her father, because
right.
he died. But this father absence, it's a fact,
mm-hmm.
right? Mrs. Pearson comments on it. These are families. We're conditioned to be split up.
Well, Luke Edward, do I have this right, is little niece's god.
She loves him.
She looks up to him. He is beautiful. He is indolent.
He's fun-loving. He's sharp.
Uh-huh.
He's hip.
But
he's
not headed in the right direction, is he?
He's not headed in the right
direction. Unlike David, his brother, who is a hard worker and who knuckles under, not only within his own context, but to the white world in the larger sense. You have a kind of polarity there. Again, I want to figure out what A.J. Verdell is saying to us about Black men.
Well, there's definitely a polarity between David and Luke Edward, one that's designed for demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
David, however, though he is described as heading in the right direction, is really not what Denise thought he would be. Denise comes back to Detroit at age 12, five formative years spent down the country, and she is stunned. She thought her brothers would be very much like her,
yeah.
and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They're not worried about anything. In fact, David is a furniture delivery man. She thought he would be a carpenter. They all thought he would be a carpenter, which to them is a good, productive skill.
Uh-huh.
But he's not doing that. He's working in a plant at one point and at furniture delivery at the other.
And Luke Edward, on the other hand, is
running the streets.
Yeah.
And that's not that uncommon either.
Yep.
Both of them are very sort of standard kinds of black men that we expect to encounter. And I think that the sort of knee-jerk reaction to what is our situation with black men is about their fatherlessness, that father absence. But Denise really has the question, and I think A.J. Verdell has the question, appropriately or not, what do we women have to do with what our boys become? Because we are so good at matriarchs in training. Right? And it's not just role modeling. We're telling Denise constantly, sit up, stand up, speak up, learn, study, cook, clean, shop, walk, talk. We're telling her exactly what to do. Marguerite and Denise fight all the time about what Denise should wear.
Is this, are you condemning the sort of implicit sexism that discriminates in subtle and various directions all at the same time for and against little boys and little girls, black children?
Well, you know, sexism is again a complicated problem. I think what I'm really saying, and this feeds into my own superwoman complex. I mean, I think black matriarchy lends itself to superwomanism,
yeah.
And it's inappropriate. But as the impetus for writing this book, that's where I come from. And I feel like if you can make such a good statue out of me, then you ought to be able to make a better statue out of my brother. And it's a devastating hurt, this idea that somebody who's my same age, Anthony, when I grow up, I'm going to have a business, I'm going to make a certain amount of money, I'm going to be able to write a book, and he can't speak English? That's really scary and really sad. I feel a responsibility to be as sharp and as intelligent as I possibly can be as an artist, because that is the first thing that's going to be denied me as a black woman, as a Negress, as an African American. That no, you can't be fluid linguistically, no, you can't be gymnastic intellectually, and that's absolutely necessary for me in order to be successful in the world that I live in, both in terms of my business profession as well as in terms of my artistic endeavors. So I feel a very, very strong responsibility to do that well and to do that in an intellectual and intelligent fashion, because that's who I am.
Angela Verdell, your novel is The Good Negress. Let's hear you read another passage to us. What's going on here?
Okay, Wayne, the passage I'm about to read is she's finished cleaning up the house, and so she's discovered a lot of things. When she first comes, she tries to put herself in the house in a sort of spiritual way by cleaning up everything, and that's how she gets familiar. I only had that one party at Marguerite's. Most of the rest of the time I lived there, I was alone. I cleaned and studied and learned to play the hi-fi. In the back of Marguerite's closet, I had found something that wasn't hers. It was too big and it was too old for anything she would like to wear. The first time I stumbled on it, I was scared Marguerite might come in and catch me there, so I didn't pull it out. But once I got her schedule down good, and once I knew the schedules of the rest of the house, I could go in there and take my time. The porter's smock had the word Southern machine stitched on the sleeve. It was white, but dulled to maize by time. From the size of it, you would think my daddy was almost as big as Big Jim. Of course, I don't know how it fit. The sleeves were long, and seven large buttons proceeded down the front. From the way it smelled, you would think my daddy wore Marguerite's perfume. I usually went to look at the smock when Marguerite first left the house, because then I could know that she wouldn't come in on me. I was scared to take it off the hanger for a while. One day, I was playing little Anthony. I had decided they were my favorites. I went to Marguerite's closet and took the smock off the hanger rod. I took the smock off the hanger and put the hanger on the doorknob. I stood in front of Marguerite's vanity and held the smock up in front of me. It had Southern Railroad stitched on the chest pocket, too. Little Anthony sang, and in the mirror, I danced behind the smock. Then I turned the smock with its procession of buttons to face me. I threw the right arm over my shoulder and rubbed my hand up and down the back. 8 buttons there were. I held the left arm out. We danced. If we could start anew, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd gladly take you back and tempt the hands of fate. Tears on my pillow, pain in my heart caused by you.
You don't remember me, but I remember you. 'Twas not so long ago you broke my heart in two. Tears on my pillow, pain in my heart caused by hand of fate. Tears on my pillow, pain in my heart caused by you.
Love is not. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was novelist A.J. Verdell. Her new book is The Good Negress, available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. A.J. Verdell is now at work on a new novel about African Americans moving west following the Civil War. Cassette tapes of this program are available postpaid for $10. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 754. That's number 754. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week, part 3 of Soundings for Women's History Month. Dee Soini Madison of UNC Chapel Hill will be here to talk about her new book, The Woman That I Am, a collection about the literature and culture of contemporary women of color. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.